Therefore, that money piled up in the foreign places. That money was then used to buy our exports in that country.
Randy, this would help me. Go into the money flow. So I'm an immigrant here in New York City.
Yep.
And I save $200 and I want to send it back to my brother.
Yep.
Over in Germany.
Okay.
And it's 1905.
Yep.
So what do I do with my $200 American dollars? I walk into the bank or?
There's several ways to do it. One of which is simply get an envelope, put the paper money, well, there wasn't any Federal Reserve notes at the time. You could either use bank notes from one of the New York banks, depending on where you had your money, or you'd have to put it in a bag because it was specie, gold or silver, and then try and ship that through the mail, which I don't think you'd be willing to do.
Well, wait a minute. This immigrant wouldn't have a banking account in 1905.
No, that's right. Well, but you could go down to the bank and say, I've got this gold and silver. I want to send it to my brother over in Germany. And the bank says, whoa, we can handle that transaction for you. Let us provide you with a bank voucher. You give us your money, and we will give you this bank voucher that you can put in an envelope and send to your brother in Germany. And when he gets it over there, he can then take it to the bank over there as a voucher and present it, and they will give him German money, depending on the exchange rate and the various charges that might be associated with redeeming or reclaiming that bank voucher in Germany.
So the New York City bank would have a relationship with some German bank where his brother lived.
That's correct. And they would also have a relationship with the flow of goods that were passing from the United States to Germany as imports to Germany and exports from the United States, so that that purchasing power over there was lined up against their importation of goods from the United States.
Yes, but give the money flow around the goods.
Well, the money is related to the goods. In other words, that's what he's saying. This, without the foreign trade aspect of it, then the translation of the money would be meaningless to the Germans. They are receiving an influx of purchasing power from the United States.
Wait. The United States, there's an exporter in New York City, and he's exporting lumber to Germany.
Set. Actually, he's probably exporting, lumber. So, okay.
So the German importer of that lumber pays the New York City exporter of that lumber with dollar bills.
Well, no, not necessarily. How did he come by the dollar bills? Are they U.S. dollar bills? You mean bank notes? Because that's all there was then as far as paper money goes.
Okay. Well, he comes by some kind of American money. Because Germany exported some products to New York City, and New York City paid with American money.
Yeah, but the American money doesn't buy anything in Germany. It all has to be translated into the local currency in 1905.
It doesn't buy anything in Germany, but the German importer can pay for New York City exports with it.
Well, they can promise to pay. That's what banks do. They issue promises.
I'm talking about the exporter and the importer.
Yeah. They're both dealing with banks, some way to get the payment done.
Right. And the money is going back and forth across the Atlantic Ocean.
No,
our dollars
not.
Are going over there.
No, they're not. The dollars don't move. In 1905, the only thing that moved was gold and silver. That's it. Goods and gold and silver. And promises on paper.
Right. Bank paper.
Not necessarily bank paper. If it was bank paper, it was specific paper that had to be signed by this bank or that receiver or shipper.
Yeah.
It was specific.
What did they call that? There was this paper that the banks used.
Banker's acceptances.
Yeah, there you go. Now, were they being used in 1905?
Not much here. They, in Europe, yes.
Okay. Because after 1920, we became more, our banks became more of the issuers of banker acceptances in world trade.
And you know why? Because it was part of the specification of the Federal Reserve Act.
Okay, tell us the part in the Federal Reserve Act.
Well, we have to look it up here. Branch offices, banks. Stock issues. Earnings, Federal Reserve Board, powers of Federal Reserve Banks. Nothing in this act contained shall be construed to prohibit such notes, drafts, and bills of exchange secured by staple agricultural products or other goods, wares, or merchandise from being eligible for such discount, but such definition shall not include notes, drafts, or bills covering merely investments or issued or drawn for the purpose of carrying or trading in stocks, bonds, or other investment securities, except bonds and notes of the government of the United States. Notes, drafts, and bills admitted to discount under the terms of this paragraph must have a maturity at the time of discount of not more than 90 days, provided that notes, drafts, and bills drawn or issued for agricultural purposes or based on livestock and having a maturity not exceeding 6 months may be discounted in an amount to be limited to a percentage of the capital of the Federal Reserve Bank to be ascertained and fixed by the Federal Reserve Board. Any Federal Reserve Bank may discount acceptances which are based on the importation or exportation of goods and which have a maturity at time of discount of not more than 3 months and endorsed by at least one member bank. The amount of acceptances so discounted shall at no time exceed one half the paid up capital stock and surplus of the bank for which the rediscounts are made. Any member bank may accept drafts or bills of exchange, yada, yada, yada. But no banks shall accept such bills to amount equal to at any time to the aggregate more than one half its paid up capital stock and surplus. Was let's see here, no national banking association shall at any time be indebted or in any way liable to an amount exceeding the amount of its capital stock at such time actually paid in and remaining undiminished by losses or otherwise, except on account of demands of the nature following. First, notes of circulation. Second, monies deposited with or collected by the association. Third, bills of exchange or drafts drawn against money actually on deposit to the credit of the association or due thereto. Fourth, liabilities to the stockholders of the association for dividends and reserve profits. Fifth, liabilities incurred under the provisions of the Federal Reserve Act. The rediscount by any Federal Reserve Bank of any bills receivable and of domestic and foreign bills of exchange and of acceptances authorized by this act shall be subject to such restrictions, limitations, and regulations as may be imposed by the Federal Reserve Board.
Let me read something from my paper.
Okay.
On World War One.
Yep.
Okay. And quote, one of the sources I found researching this paper was an article written by David C. Wheelock of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis in November 2013. Quote, the Fed's formative years, 1913 to 1929, end quote. In this article, I found the following, and this is from his article. World War I disrupted European financial markets and reduced the supply of trade credit, and I put in loans, offered by European banks.
Right.
Providing U.S. banks with an opening. Low U.S. interest rates, abundant reserves, and new authority to issue trade acceptances,
yep.
And I put in parentheses, my own words, acceptances, create deposits for loans to exporters and importers. And that's my...
Yeah.
Okay. Enabled American banks to finance a growing share of world trade by meaning giving these loans, creating the money, giving the loans to these exporters and importers.
Offering credit, yeah, that's right. Yep.
Yeah. By the second half of the 1920s, over half of U.S. imports and exports were financed by dollar-denominated acceptances, as was a large share of the international trade of other countries. And he puts in a reference to an article by Eichen Green, that was the man's last name, 2011. The strength of the U.S. economy and the greater use of the dollar for making international payments made the dollar the world's leading reserve currency.
Right.
By the mid-1920s, foreign governments and central banks held more of their foreign exchange reserves in dollars than in any other currency. And that's also from Eichen Green, 2012.
Right.
So that's, that focuses that trade acceptances were loans to exporters and importers.
It also, what it fails to mention right there, and what you're presuming, is that that money, that there was money behind those promises.
You mean reserves?
Even the reserves, that's correct. You're presuming that there was actually money behind those. It's not, it's credit. That is the banks creating credit out of thin air by writing it down on a piece of paper.
Yes, so they didn't move the gold and silver back and forth across the Atlantic.
They
just
tried
gave
not.
These IOUs.
They tried, yeah, they tried to keep that. They from time to time, over the course of any given year, there may be some attempts to try to balance the what they call the current account for any nation, which is the trade imbalance. If you owe more, you have to send gold out. If you are owed have to bring gold in. So from time to time during any given year, some attempts are made to try to ship gold and balance those accounts. But even when you get to that stage of payments, all the time the bankers are working like ducks on the water. They're all serene up top, but underneath they're paddling like hell and trying to figure out how they can offset what I owe you against what you owe me.
Right.
And so it all tries to get worked out on paper, and if necessary, we'll even take those differences in who owes what to who and try and hypothecate that, try and use that as a basis for more credit issuance.
Right.
So we don't have to move the gold.
Right.
And silver. That was how it was working then, yes. These days, hardly anything moves, including money. That's what EFT is all about, electronic funds transfer. Money doesn't circulate at all. That's really what brought down the Silicon Valley Bank. People started hitting the ATMs and pulling out Federal Reserve notes, which aren't really money, they're fake money. They're near money, but they aren't money. By the admission of the Federal Reserve Act itself, they're not lawful money. But nonetheless, they try to signify money. They're a promise of money. So they're one step removed from real money. At least one, maybe two or three, who knows. Doesn't matter. Once you get one step beyond it, you can take as many as you're allowed to, as you can get away with.
Okay, but let's get back to this paragraph.
Yeah.
Describing these 38 years and the money flows.
Well.
Right.
The money flows are supposedly represented by these acceptances. But it's the acceptances that are moving, not the money.
Yeah. Okay. Granted. Okay. So I'm just looking at this, this introductory paragraph in the middle of 221.
Yeah.
And I have to keep reminding myself it's for 38 years, right?
Right. Yep.
So the first report, let's see.
Showed how we managed to work up a vast foreign trade on the formula of giving anything to anyone who asks for it.
So what, up to World War I, what was our goods going back out and in to our country? Does he have that in the figures?
He didn't present those specifically in the text of this book, no. He does for when he gets into the next chapter. Was it the next chapter? No, it's the second chapter on. He gets into the specifics of the agreements with Cuba and Brazil and Belgium.
But he does say, we managed to work up a vast foreign trade.
Yep.
This is the first report. On the formula of giving anything to anyone who asks for it. It was the harvest time for the bankers, the exporters, and the shipping men. Because all these exports. So he's talking about a lot of exports.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. Because, the shipper will get paid, right? Doesn't matter who's exporting what to who, it has to go there somehow.
Right.
At that time, we didn't have air transport. So it either had to be shipped out of this country on a ship, or it went to Canada or to Mexico. Any other place that it is headed for has to go on a ship.
Right.
So the shippers always get paid because the exporter sees that in order for the transaction to be consummated, it has to be put on a ship and sent. And the only way you're going to get somebody to say, yes, I'll carry that on my ship, is to pay them.
Right. So all of this exporting up to World War I,
right,
it benefited mostly the bankers, the exporters, and the shipping men.
Yep.
Okay. then the second report, what is the second report focused on?
We didn't get there. Oh, there. It's on the next page. We didn't finish this one, did we?
No, but it says
no,
the second report.
The second report showed the way that the book credit of $22.645 billion showed the way that the book credit took refuge in various sorts of holdings and securities.
Now, you know, we'd have to look at this report.
And the third report showed how our nation continued to follow and develop against the plain records of the books policies which have rid the credits of a large part of their asset value.
Okay, so we have to analyze these reports.
Well, what he's saying is that the... We already had... We had debts out there. People owed us, right? And what he's saying is that the people who put the deals together, the bankers, through the exporters working through the bankers, and the shippers who carried the stuff, those people made money, and the people who actually produced the goods to go on the boat, financed by the bankers, by the exporters asking for financing to get the stuff moved and sold and rack up a debt over there to be paid to us, what we got paid didn't get to the producers.
Right.
Our producers never got paid. And the debts, which had already been racked up, $22.6 billion, was never contemplated in the way of settlements or payments, was not included in the policy of the United States that was worth asking them to pay for.
Right, and that's for the 38-year period.
Yep.
Okay. So I think we should go on and actually see the details of this.
Go on where?
Well, he summarizes what the accounts show. Do you want to go through that?
Well, the first thing he said was the first period, and that the first period, is that what he's referring to before World War One?
Yes.
Okay. That's when the immigrants in this country were sending American, I don't want to use the word money, but something American credit back home or something.
Yeah, they were trying to, they earned, what they thought they were doing here was earning money. They were getting paid, probably for the first time in their experience, their life experience. They were actually paid for work done. Golly gosh, what a novel concept. You know, status was not figured into how much their hours of labor were worth, which is what they had experienced in Europe. You know, if you're an Irish potato farmer, it doesn't matter how many potatoes you produce, they ain't worth nothing to anybody other than the fact that the overseers like to get paid rent. So they'll pay you enough on your potatoes so that they can get their rent back. Other than that, screw you. You're just an Irish potato farmer. Your work ain't worth near as much as what mine is as a renter, as a landlord. Ha ha ha. Over here, they could go to work at any place, and what they got paid was based on what they did. This was a novel experience for them. So that when they got some nickels to rub together, they wanted to send those back home and share their wealth with their family back across the ocean. So try to do that. Try to send money out of the country. He, in fact, does have entries in this accounting that show just how much credit was trying to be exchanged.
And by sending money, you're talking about the money is not credit. It's the gold.
Well, it is over here. and it should be over there. This is the way people think. You know, money is money is money. So, of course, when you try to get into the question of how do I send U.S. money back to my family in Ireland, where they use British pounds sterling as money, how do I make that happen? Well, I can't make that happen. I have to go to a bank and have them help me.
Or to an exchange, currency exchange business.
Right, which is also working through a bank.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. So there's an agency there. And the agency, if you follow it through far enough, you'll find that at some point, it's government to government based upon some exchange ratio.
What do you mean it's government to government? I thought it was bank to bank.
Well, the government sets the policies. The government sets the policy of how much the dollar is worth. The British government sets the policy of how much the pound sterling is worth. And from that point on, then you can do your calculations on how much dollars exchange for pound sterling.
It's a government function?
Well, the government sets the policy on the value of the currency. The banks have to work within that.
I didn't know that. I thought it was the Federal Reserve today.
I thought you were talking about 1905.
Yeah, so it was the Treasury Department?
They're what, right. Well, yes, acting through as the administrative arm of our government, yes. As Congress passes a law that says, okay, this is how we're going to run our economy this year, we're gonna spend this much, and the banks take all this information, they try and crunch it down, and other people coming and going across the border say, oh gosh, I can get this for that, and the process of exchanges and everything all comes to a head, and the Treasury says, well, okay, at this point in time, we're trying to maintain our currency as the U.S. dollar equivalent to how many ever pounds sterling there might be. You know, they set that rate at that time.
Okay.
You know, after World War One, the British tried to keep the pound sterling at, $20.67 gold. As far as the dollar went, they tried to maintain the British pound at, well, it was around, what, 4.85? I think the British pound sterling was like equivalent to $4.85 U.S., at that time. They thought that even after having it's a morass of numbers and
yeah, no kidding,
interactive shenanigans that, well, and there's a reason for that. If nobody can follow what you're doing, particularly as it happens from day to day, then we can essentially do anything we want to, as long as we don't upset the system, the expectations of our friends in Britain, our friends in Germany, meaning the banks and bankers and the policy makers in those countries. As long as we don't upset our relationships too much, we can kind of plan on how many pounds sterling are going to exchange for a dollar, and therefore we can make our deals and write our deals on paper and get the banks to underwrite what we think those valuations are, and yada, 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 yada.
Well, I know from my reading that there was a close relationship, even more than a business relationship, between the head of the Bank of England and the president of the New York Fed.
Right. Well, that was at 1905.
No, I'm talking about after World War One, when England attempted to keep the gold standard.
Right, yeah.
And Zalanga goes into that, as well as other authors.
Right.
Who does? What did you say, Sue?
Zalanga goes into post World War I, the close cooperation between the Bank of England governor, head governor, and the New York Fed head president. And these are probably the two most powerful men in the world at that time. And the New York Fed, they had more than a business relationship. There was something interpersonal going on between them. But anyway, the policies of the New York Federal Reserve were promulgated in order to keep the English currency on the gold standard.
Without devaluing. We tried to help them,
And it had something to do with interest rates in New York City. In New York.
Well, the interest rates in New York City were manipulated to try to assist the British to maintain the pound sterling at pre-war valuations.
Right. So how did they do that? Was it the interest rate kept high on this side of the Atlantic?
Well, high on what? You know, if you have to reference a specific transaction, if it was an interest rate on cutting a deal with Britain that on things that were valued in British pounds, then if you tried to make the deal thinking that the British pound was worth less, then yeah, we'd raise the interest rate to try and keep that valuation up near where the British wanted it.
Yeah. Huh. So there was this manipulation going on between this and by the central bankers after World War I.
Well, just like the housing crisis in 2008. Golly gosh, we want these houses moved. We want these mortgages. We want mortgages out there. So we're going to cut the rate on mortgages. Go to it, boys, hurry. By reducing the interest rate on mortgages, we can sell lots more of them. Because the cost per mortgage is reduced. That's what they're trying to do now with raising the interest rates, saying, hey, slow down on this credit creation stuff here, boys. We're going to increase. You're going to have to pay more if you want to create some extra credit. It's going to cost you. You better slow down. That's what the Fed is saying today.
We got a minute and a half.
Okay, give me a minute to set up another meeting and start it.
And then we look for a new link from you?
It'll be the same
information. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm here.
I got to go get a drink here, so I'll be back.
I'm going to go do the same thing.
We'll leave Jerry to figure out who she's talking to.
Yeah.
Ah, I made
Jerry,
it.
Randy and I are going to get a drink, and we'll be back.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
You there, Jerry?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
You know, I was thinking, I'm reading this book about Robert Morris from the Revolution, the financier of the Revolution.
Yeah.
And it's written, oddly enough, by a guy named Robert Morris. But he uses a lot of the original writings of Morris, you know, his letters and all of that. And what appears to be him, that what he's describing is the same thing for what Robert Morris was doing as what we're talking about right now in terms of...
Right.
Right? Do you think that... I'd have to go back and look at...
Well, yeah, the process probably hasn't changed. It didn't change a lot between the revolutionary period and 1905.
Okay.
You know, you remember the chart in the 1941 publication about the purchasing power of the dollar, how it rose and fell from 1792 through 1900.
And prosperity was within our grasp, that chart?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, yeah. Right.
Yeah, that came out of Congress. That was published by Congress, and how it rose and fell. Sometimes it was $1.20, sometimes it was 76 cents. But at the end of the period, it was the purchasing power of the dollar was approximately the same as it was when it started.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, not a whole lot changed, other than seasonally, we had our ups and our downs and our panics and our booms and things like that. But yeah, the mechanism by which trade was affected and the economy developed kind of maintained a fairly consistent track. That's not true any longer since the Fed Reserve came in.
Okay, yeah, and that chart didn't go, that went to 1941.
No, but I can gin up a chart while I have. Just look at the parity chart. The parity chart starts to rise after...
That's a 100-cent dollar, right, that chart?
Yes, yep, 100-cent dollar, that's the one. Yep. And as soon as the Fed Reserve comes in, the 100-cent dollar becomes a thing of the past. It sinks during the Great Depression. We hit World War II and it begins to rise. Came up quite a bit. It leveled off after the war during the post-war parity period, the post-war boom. And then it began to rise again because of the dissolution of parity until 1971. It sank slowly from 52 to 71. When Nixon took us off the international gold standard, and we went to completely arbitrary international exchange rates, and it has turned into a hyperbolic function ever since then. And our dollar today is compared with 1905 or 1913, our dollar today, the purchasing power is worth about 2 cents.
Yeah. So wait a minute. On that chart, the populace period, the dollar was worth, I mean, close to $2.95, and the price of farm goods was negative, was in negative territory, right? There was a big difference between, it was below the 100-cent dollar line.
Hang on a second, I have got to find the...
I'm back, sorry.
Oh, you're...
Oh, you must have had a, drank the lake.
I got waylaid. Easy story.
We're looking at prosperities within our grasp, the 100-cent chart, because I brought up the idea that the book I'm reading on Robert Morris is describing kind of the same kind of thing, how he was collecting money and shipping goods and all of that stuff. There was a lot of different mechanisms, but one of them seemed to be just what we're describing right here. I mean, they had privateer ships where they just, you know, send these ships out to steal the British merchandise and whatever, and bring them home for the soldiers and stuff like that. But some of it was the exchanges that are being, we're talking about right now, that was going on, what how Peake is describing it since 1896.
Hmm. Yeah, that chart in the in Prosperity, is it within our grasp?
Yeah.
Is on page 9 or whatever it is. Actually, PDF page 13. It's marked as page 9, numbered in the original as page 9. This is what the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Forestry said. In 1800, the dollar was valued in commodities 100 cents. In 1812, the dollar was valued in commodities 155 cents. In 1830, 66. 1860, 61. 1865, 132. 1880, 59. 1896, 46 cents. In 1919, the dollar was valued at 154 cents.
That's in terms of commodities, right? In terms
yes.
So the wars were affecting how much the commodities would be worth.
Well, of course.
Okay. So the Revolutionary War would affect it, too.
Well, the Revolutionary War is not within 1800.
No, I know. I'm just thinking of this book. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, the chart kind of sticks in my mind. It's really, and the dollar in 1896 or something was, they were valued, that's when they had that big commotion over gold. They were trying to get gold instated. Cleveland was, Grover Cleveland. And Morgan was helping them out.
Well, 1896 said the dollar was valued in commodities at 46 cents.
In commodities, but the dollar itself was $2, the line above.
Well, it's 1 over 46, so it'd be slightly over $2, yeah.
I mean, that was the biggest gap in those years of any on that whole, in that whole chart.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I bet now, it would be, I mean, you wouldn't have a chart. It would be off the charts, right?
Well, that's why I had to put the parity chart, the one parity chart that I constructed, I had to use a logarithmic scale on the y-axis in order to present the curve. Otherwise, the curve would have been off the page at the top before the graph ever got to the end.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Okay, Sue, on with your concerns. You were saying something, I think, before.
Well, I was wondering, in the 1920s, after World War One and after the Depression of 1921, England went back to the gold standard, but it was
tried to.
They tried, and it was a agreement between the central bankers of England and the U.S.
Yep.
So I went to my...
And that stood, by the way, that stood. They tried to do that for as long a period as they tried to until the New York bankers saw that they had an opportunity to put the whole thing in their own pocket. And that's when we finally told the British, no, we ain't gonna do this anymore.
Well, let me read something from my slide show of Zarlanga's book about the this period. And I'm gonna share the screen. How's this? And you can see it. Tell me when you can see it. Can you see it?
No, blank screen.
Yeah, Sue has started screen sharing, that's it.
How's that?
There we go.
Okay. Okay, so this, the title is England's Gold Standard Ideology Causes the 1920s Frenzy.
Yeah.
England returns to gold standard in 1925. And this is from Zarlanga's Lost Science of Money, page 543.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, the Federal Reserve System supported the Bank of England by keeping interest rates low in America, encouraging the export of gold to Europe.
Right.
However, the U.S. money supply became progressively more leveraged, being based on smaller reserves, right, and more bank credit, and the low interest rates helped to fuel the stock market bubble, driving prices up to unrealistic levels from which a collapse was likely.
Yep.
So my mind doesn't work around this stuff, but anyway, by the New York bankers keeping the interest rates low in America, so there was more taking out loans to invest by people in this country and probably in other countries coming here to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was before 1920, right? I mean, that panic of 1921, they raised the interest rates.
Right, but let's stick with this period. With England going back to the gold standard in 1925.
Right, well, that's what I'm trying to do, because the interest rates were raised around 1920. They were low before that, right? Or am I getting something
wrong? Well, it didn't matter during the war. I don't know whether they were high or low during the war, or whether they were raised or maintained steady or dropped. The point is, during the war, if we have to spend, we're going to spend. Doesn't matter what the interest rates are.
Yeah, we have all those $30 billion of Liberty loans.
That's correct.
By our treasury.
I'm talking about the panic of 1920-21, because they decided to raise the interest rates within an 8-month period from like 2% to 9% or more in rural areas.
Right, and all the farmers were in, had taken out a lot of debt, and
right, they were encouraged to.
Yeah,
deflation.
War effort.
Yep.
Okay, so this goes on. This is a quote from H. Parker Willis, as quoted by Mullins in the Federal Reserve Conspiracy, page 95. Quote, in the autumn of 1926, a group of bankers met in a Washington hotel. One asked if the low discount rates of the system were not likely to encourage speculation. Yes, replied the famous banker. Quote, they will, but that cannot be helped. It is the price we must pay for helping Europe.
Yep.
So that, you know, that says a lot about who is manipulating the economy and rates and everything.
Well, it's also the same attitude that was expressed by Cordell Hull in the early days of, as Secretary of State, during the early days of the Roosevelt first administration, and by Henry Aggravating Wallace. Both of them. They did the same thing. They wanted to help world peace. They wanted to run the world. They wanted to save the world.
I don't think they really were wanted peace.
Come on. That's what they said.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, peace wouldn't make them much money.
Well, I don't doubt but what Henry Wallace was sincere.
Okay.
He didn't have enough practical experience to know that what he was doing was endangering world peace.
Mm-hmm.
He believed.
Right.
He didn't know.
Well, you have less skepticism than I do.
Well,
I'm seeing where Randy, I can see that perspective, that he believed a lot.
I think Cordell Hull was intentionally the tool of the same interests. I don't think Henry Wallace realized how much of a tool he was.
Well, that could be true.
That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Right. So this is the next slide. Another quote from Zarlanga. So the American currency was destabilized to help the Bank of England fulfill its gold obligations. The testimony reveals that the automatic gold standard was a myth, and that back then the Federal Reserve System's power really resided in the New York Fed. The European bankers spent 2 weeks there and not even one full day in Washington, D.C.
Right. You know,
all at the Fed.
Yep. You know.
And here's the House Stabilization Hearings of 1928. House Stabilization Hearings. Governor, in the hearings, Governor Adolph Miller, I guess he was a governor of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve Board last summer, 1927, set out by a policy of open market purchases, followed in course by reduction on the discount rate at the Reserve Banks. That's the rate that banks can borrow reserves from their Fed.
Right.
To ease the credit situation and to cheapen the cost of money. The official reasons for that departure in credit policy were that it would help to stabilize international exchange and stimulate the exportation of gold.
Right.
Sounds like he's talking about we'll have peace, everyone will be happy. But anyway, Chairman McFadden, where did the suggestions come from that caused this decision of the change of rates last summer? Governor Adolph Miller. The three largest central banks in Europe had sent representatives to this country. They were the governor of the Bank of England, Mr. Montagu Norman, the president of the German Reichsbank, Mr. What is it?
Kalmar.
I can't pronounce German, like. But that's good.
The J has sounded like a Y. Kalmar.
Right. Yeah.
And Professor Rist, R-I-S-T, deputy governor of the Bank of France. These gentlemen were in conference with officials of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. They were therefore desirous of seeing an easy money market in New York and lower rates. Mr. Stiegel, is it true that action stabilized the European currencies and upset ours? Governor Adolph Miller.
No.
Yes,
God.
That is what it was intended to do.
Oh, my God. I'm going to take out billboards.
Well, do you think that Jay Powell is doing anything different today?
No,
not at all.
Correct.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. Back to Pete, because I'm trying to understand the money.
Okay, we are on 222, still on the first report, right? The first period.
Yeah.
And we, I think the sentence that we got hung up on was, the chief function of our foreign trade during the period up to the war was to provide funds for our immigrants to send to their relatives abroad.
Right.
That's where we stopped.
Yeah. And we should visit periodically how people move money from one country to another.
Right.
I really don't understand the transactions.
I know. Could we draw some kind of a flow chart or something? I don't know. Anyway, listen to Randy. Because it's the same thing with USA when Randy's describing how USAID operates. I go and try to...
Well, it's because you're sticking too close to the world of reality. In order to understand banking, you have to leave the real world. Yes, and I agree with you that most of us have such a tenuous grasp of our own real world.
Exactly.
That we are afraid to let go of it.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's correct. That is what they claim to be their advantage. And what that results in, by the way, is exactly the political situation we as a nation are facing today. And have for the last 10 years, at least, if not longer. We don't understand it. We're trying desperately to get our grasp on it. And all the time, they are operating outside the bounds of reality and laughing about it. How these dolts are trying to understand what we're doing. Like Lily Tomlin. Lily Tomlin she used to do a one-woman show on Broadway. I think the character she had was what, Earlene or something like that. I forget just what the name of the character was now. And one of the lines Lily has Earlene say is, what? Sanity? No, 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 no. Since I've given up sanity and reality, my days are jam-packed and fun-filled. Exactly. So they're just all having wonderful... This is exactly, in fact, the source of the comment I attributed as the source of the comment about from Alan Greenspan. Or green scam, as though the Federal Reserve's job is to take away the punch bowl when the party gets too raucous. Irrational exuberance. Yeah. See, we have to control the irrational exuberance of all these pit traders and money changers and stock traders and jobbers and bond salesmen and everybody else. All these shadow bankers, and we have to control their irrational exuberance by taking the punch bowl away when the party is getting too rambunctious, too frothed up. We have to take the punch bowl away, which means increase interest rates. We have to charge them more, make them pay more, make it more costly for them to engage in their irrational exuberance.
And stop rolling over their loans and start calling in their loans.
Well, yeah, to some degree. And that's the phrase, of course, called pulling the string. So the Federal Reserve pulls the string of outstanding loans. They pull the string, try to call in some of those loans. And like Wilkins said, well, pulling the string is fine, but if you want to try and turn that around, how do you push on a string? All you can do is shut the thing down. And when you start shutting things down, guess who goes first? All of your raw materials production, all your processing, all your manufacturing, all the real economy, economy that depends on real money, or real people's sustenance, livelihoods, and all that stuff goes first, because the finance arm of the economy will save itself when it sees this roadblock coming and push the cost on down to all those people that cannot avoid the cost. And so it shuts down the real economy first. Then we get into a real pickle. You can't push on a string.
So I want to request that we do the accounting on page 222 for the first period, 1896 to 1914, right?
Yeah.
And it says here, during the period, we sold goods to the world. Okay? So
yep.
American goods were sold, and it was, let's say, $31
billion. Yep.
We took goods, and then so foreign goods were bought.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
Bought for
$22 billion.
$22
billion. Yep.
Okay. This left the world owing us the sum of $8.9 billion.
Or $9 billion, yep.
$9 billion.
Yep.
That's owed to the US. So they owed that, meaning they owed the importers in Europe owed that to the No, the exporters in Europe owed that to the importers in this country.
Okay. Well, not necessarily. It's just that when you, individually, if you look at the transactions, there may have been some shortfall here, there, yonder. But what he's looking at is the valuation of these items as they left the country and as they entered the country in terms of our own money.
Oh, in terms of U.S. dollars?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So in other words, we sent out too much of our money.
Yep. And he says, we did not take goods in return for all the goods that we sold, because we neither needed them nor wanted them. We had no reason to import foodstuffs, and we were building up our own factories. We thought we were doing a big business, and since everyone seemed to be getting paid, no one inquired how we were getting paid.
So we were... Our factories were producing. We didn't
yep.
need to buy all the
yep.
stuff from Europe.
That's right.
But the producers in this country were getting paid, right?
Well, that's what it says. Yep.
Okay.
It now appears from the account that the nation was not getting paid.
Because more dollars had left the country.
Yep.
Okay. We thought we were doing a big business, and since everyone seemed to be getting paid, no one inquired. Okay. It now appears that the account at the Nation was not getting paid. Are immigrants and tourists, the tourist trade was comparably small, sent or spent abroad? Okay, so now you have U.S. immigrants.
Yep, and they're immigrants sending, into this country.
They're sending abroad $6 billion.
Or tourists abroad are spending, yep.
Yeah, $6 billion.
Yep.
To the foreign countries. This still left the world in our debt. Okay, so wait a minute. What does that mean? This still, so.
In other words, we sent value abroad in the amount of just over $6 billion, compared to the $8.8 or $9 billion that we were owed.
But that means more U.S. dollars went away into foreign countries.
Right. This still left the world in our debt in the sum of $2.7 billion. In other words, subtract 6.08 from 8.853, and you come up with 2.773.
No, but wait a minute. We sold $31 billion, so $31 billion went out of our country. $22 billion came back in because we bought foreign goods.
Yep.
That left $9 billion owed to us.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're sending additional $6 billion out. Isn't that another $6 billion that's owed to us?
No, it's not owed to us. It was spent or sent or taken out of the country. It's not ours. It's paid for the services we've purchased.
No, the U.S. immigrants were sending that to their relatives.
Yeah.
So that's U.S. dollars going out of the country, no?
No, it's not. That's
I'm confused. See, I don't understand this flows.
Well, if I go to Vienna and I go through the museums over there, I'm spending my purchasing power abroad, right?
Right. And I purchased...
I can't spend a U.S. dollar over there. I have to take my dollar and trade it for Vienna marks.
Yes.
Austrian marks.
Right.
And so then the banks get together and decide how much they're going to keep for foreign exchange reserves, and they barter with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And they say, Federal Reserve Bank of New York, I've got some Federal Reserve notes, or I've got some U.S. purchasing power on account over here. That's yours. I mean, it's only good in your country, and I exchange it here for our money, which means that we owe you a bunch of U.S. notes, and you owe us a bunch of Austrian marks, and we know you've got some on hand over there because of some prior transactions or whatever. So we need to settle those out, and so what it comes down to is that they get together and they balance the books. And they say, okay, well, all in all, there's this much gold valuation involved. And seeing how our people bought your stuff, we owe it to you.
Right, but this is the U.S. immigrants sending our money to foreign relatives.
Same thing. Same thing. It's got to be purchased in the amount of it goes against what they owe us. We sent it over there. So it's outside our country. It has to come back somehow.
Okay. Okay, I'm just dense with this. Okay, so going on here. So the world is in our debt still for $3 billion, right?
Yep.
Owed to the U.S. Okay. Adding to this debt the amount of our services to the world.
Yep, what we did for the world, yep, outside the country.
Right. Oh, okay. And deducting the amount of the interest payments we made.
To outside the country.
and the cost of the service rendered to us,
right, delivered here inside our country,
left us at the end of the period in debt to the world in the sum of $1 billion. So it reversed itself.
Right.
U.S. in debt to world. Okay. $1 billion.
This is the period up to the war.
Yeah, 1896 to 1914. Yeah, this is so foreign to me.
During this whole period, the country was short of capital, and the current notion at that time, in other words, the current notion was that we were progressing too fast to accumulate any capital. The fact is now revealed that because we did not know the state of our accounts, we permitted our immigrants to send out a considerable portion of what should have been our national savings, and we had to borrow from Europe what we should have been able to borrow at home.
So he's laying the problem square on the fact that immigrants are sending out...
No, really what he's saying is that it's, look at the biggest numbers involved was the goods trade, $9 billion. The goods trade amounted to about a $8.853 billion in trade deficit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, the foreign remittances is what it's called. It's the same thing that the Guatemalans and the Hondurans and the Nicaraguans and the Coast or the El Salvadorans, that same thing they're trying to do by coming across the border today. They're trying to get money here so they can send it back home.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, brother.
Because this experience of being able to come here and send money back home is encouraged by the Federal Reserve System. They like to get us in debt to them, because in debt to the other countries, because then they are the ones handling the transaction, and through those transactions they can become a significant player in the economic policies of those foreign nations.
Absolutely, of the world.
Yeah, and that is precisely what the game is about.
Right. We need to recycle. Come right back in, hold that thought.
I'm going to have to go here soon. My niece is coming to visit.
Oh, okay. So we should end here.
Yeah. And save it for next week.
Yeah, we'll start.
Let's go over it again.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I'm going to study parts of it.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks, everybody.
Yep. Bye, y'all.
Bye.